Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
I'm here with Daniel Paris, author of The Ownership Dividend, which is a book that should not be controversial, but for some reason is. And the premise of the book, Daniel can tell us about this more than I can, but as the title of the book suggests, this is about dividend investing, but not solely dividends. It's about buybacks, capital gains, taxation, and other things. Now, talk to me about the premise of the book, Daniel. Let's start there.
First of all, thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it. And I somewhat unexpectedly find myself cast in a contrarian position. I was making, in the book, I do make very straightforward arguments about kind of historical mean reversion for investment practices, which I think should have been uncontroversial to most investors or perhaps thoughtful investors. And the reaction that has been really interesting. I've been cast as a more of a radical or a contrarian by investors saying, listen, everything's fine now. What's the problem? And it's not really a problem. Simply, I, as a historian, am pointing out a couple characteristics of the current market. The current market meaning the last 30 years, that as a historian or as a business person, you might say are historically anomalous. And I looked into the reasons as to why the U.S. market got into this current situation and came to the conclusion that they are largely coming to an end, have come to an end starting in 2020, and that investors should prepare for, again, what should be a non-controversial mean reversion to more typical investment practices. But after nearly 40 years in the current paradigm, I've gotten a lot of pushback, really interesting pushback. So the main concept of the book, or the main assumption of the book, is that as everyone can recall in chapter one of their finance textbooks, the value of an asset is the present value of the cash flows that you receive from said asset. That's not even changed, even in the current kind of crazy paradigm. That's still in chapter one. It's just universally ignored. So that's kind of the starting position that I entered this profession 25 years ago, read all the finance books, got my CFA very quickly, and was then surprised to realize that all the rules that we were taught in school are not applied in the marketplace. And the number one rule that in this case is the fact that a cash flow to particularly minority owners, meaning a publicly traded companies, is simply not evident in the U.S. stock market and had been erased or diminished significantly over the last couple decades. And so that was number one. And a lot of investors are very, very comfortable with this idea, buy low, sell high, repeat frequently, and there is no income stream. And I simply say, well, that's fine. I looked that up in the dictionary in a previous book. Actually, if you look that up, it's called speculation. There's nothing wrong with it. It's absolutely fine. Buy low, sell high, repeat frequently to your heart's content. But let's not call that investment. An investment more narrowly defined and observed for the last 5,000 years of recorded history in almost every context, does have an income stream attached to it. And the kind of academic knowledge about that, or the math, worked out in the last century, century and a half. So I thought that was unusual. And I just had the, I guess, the nerve to point out and say, a dividend-free stock market with a lot of mature companies is unusual. And then the blowback happened. So that's kind of point one, that the notion that there should be a cash stream attached to a an investment, a growing cash stream for a growing business, maybe a flat cash stream for a flat business, whatever, but some sort of tangible asset that the minority investor would have is kind of standard in the literature and absolutely rare in the marketplace.
Yes. Now, this begs the question, what this means about the different factors, I guess. And my initial reaction is this is would be more in favor of value stocks than growth stocks. Is that right?
So my day job is a dividend-focused investor, and we are often categorized as a value manager. I certainly don't see us as a value manager in a traditional sense, but if you're going to distribute product in this marketplace, you have to play by the rules. The rules are set by a combination of government regulatory authorities and companies, third parties like Morningstar, and they, you know, they define what you do. So we're viewed as a subset of value. I do reject, however, very, very strongly, you can see the evidence of this in the marketplace of growth companies, that a successful business, including one that's continuing to grow, can also manifest its success and growth by paying a dividend. Let's look at some recent examples, Facebook and Salesforce. They announced dividends, they announced dividends that were equal to 1/10 the amount of the buyback that was announced in the case of one, and 1/8 the amount of the buyback that was announced by another. My point being that there's close to $1 trillion in buybacks operating in the U.S. stock market, the S&P 500 companies. Most of those, many of them, shall we say, manifested by so-called growth companies. Those companies are not investing every last dime back in their business. They're investing every extra dime back into the stock market. This notion that a company that declares a dividend as evidence of its success in the marketplace is also declaring simultaneously defeat in terms of growth is simply not in the, there's no evidence of that when you have $1 trillion of buybacks. Also, in almost every other period, you had growth companies paying dividends. You had companies that were coming to market with dividends at earlier times. Now, it is true, of course, that, you know, sort of biotechs that are burning money, or companies that are in distress, or companies that are really starting up and probably shouldn't be in the stock market. They should probably be, you know, at the venture capital stage. Of course, they can't pay dividends, nor should they. And there are lots of mature companies, this is my day job, that pay too much dividends. It's a handcuffing factor. And that's, you know, a risk that I have to deal with in my day job. But it is simply a Wall Street narrative and a senior executive narrative that they can get away with buybacks but not dividends because they need to be in growth mode. Mm-hmm. We all know buybacks benefit Wall Street, not Main Street, and buybacks benefit senior executives, not necessarily regular shareholders. But if they truly were faced with a challenge, the Miller and Modigliani challenge, we can get into the academic stuff if you want. I have two chapters on the academic finance history. You can skip those if you want in the book, or you can dive into them. But the evidence, the existence of wide-scale massive buybacks really takes the wind out of the sails that, oh, a company that's paying a dividend is going X growth. Because all these companies that have buying back their shares, you would essentially make the same argument. And those are the market darlings at the present time.
Yeah. Now, buybacks are more efficient from a tax perspective than dividends, are they not?
Another point of pushback, very good one. Academic finance comes into being in the 60s, 70s, and 80s when the rate of taxation on dividends was higher than on capital gains. And again, remember, the academics do theoretical capital gains. The investor has to have actually harvested capital gains. A theoretical capital gain exists on the chalkboard at the University of Chicago. A harvested capital gain requires an open market, thousands of people, a market in a good mood, and some good fortune and good timing. Very, very different, but not in the academic world. In any case, tax rates were differential. The differential began to close in 1986 with the Tax Reform Act at that time, and basically became equal between long-term capital gains and qualified dividends in 2003. There's currently no material difference in the tax rate between harvested capital gains, hint, hint, University of Chicago, a capital gain is meaningless. It's only meaningful, useful for consumption if it's a harvested capital gain, which is much harder to do. No meaningful difference between from 2003 to the present, except for one, which is timing. You can hold off on your capital loss, harvesting your cap. Oh, I'm sorry, did I say capital loss? It can also be a capital loss. It isn't always a capital gain. Most of the time, the market moves up and to the right. But you can hold off on your capital loss or your capital gain. You can time them at your convenience. Whereas a dividend payment depends on the company and the country, but generally four times a year. And so there is a present value associated with that time. It's relatively small, but it is a net present value. What I found both in 20 years of being a practitioner and in discussing this in this book and previous books is that the net present value difference of timing a capital gain or loss and a dividend payment pales in comparison to the fury and the passion of the investor who just doesn't want to pay taxes. And what I simply say is that if you wish to subordinate investment policy to tax minimization policy, that's a choice. It's a free country. And it turns out there are lots and lots of financial advisors who would rather lose money, harvest capital losses, rather than pay the tax man. And that is absolutely available as a free, you know, free choice. But it is a choice. It is not a mantra of modern finance. And again, all of the modern finance rules that we learned were in school, as it were written 50, 60, 70s, and 80s, when there was a difference in the tax rates. It just doesn't exist anymore. Again, the purpose of being a historian is to look at current situations, current rules, current practices, and ask, where did they come from? And are they still relevant? The tax argument against dividends is simply a mild preference. Now, for some people, it is a, you know, a really, really strong preference, and that's their choice. And I simply say, okay, if you want to subordinate investment policy to tax minimization, go do it. I am willing to, in effect, do the opposite. I'm more interested in business success. And if that means paying the tax man, so be it. I sleep better at night doing it that way.
Yeah. Now, if the dividends are reinvested automatically, then you don't have a harvest, right? Or how does that affect things?
No. It depends on whether tax. This would get into the weeds. But if dividends are reinvested, the dividends did hit your account. So in the taxable account, it is taxable.
Yeah,
in a retirement account, it doesn't really matter one way or the other. It is a taxable event. There's no way in a taxable account or a brokerage account, regular brokerage account. Even if you turn around and reinvest the dividends, you are hit for the income. You know, a lot of retirees take the dividends. You know, they're using it to fund consumption. A lot of retirees the last 15 years have been using not capital gains to fund consumption, but harvested capital gains to fund consumption. This was during a period when the money markets and fixed income securities and bonds had no income to speak of. The U.S. stock market has no income to speak of other than boutique managers like my firm. My firm is not a boutique manager, but the strategy that I run within the firm. So people were funding consumption through harvested capital gains at an attractive but no more attractive tax rate than qualified dividends. So again, the tax argument just really isn't there. For younger people who are not funding consumption but are going to turn around and reinvest, yes, there is a timing issue. But again, that at that point, they are choosing what types of companies to invest in. And again, that comes back to kind of the growth and value thing that, you know, the so-called growth companies don't have dividends or have de minimis ones. And the value companies have bigger dividends. Reject that characterization, but I acknowledge that most people operate that way. They can avoid any taxation early in their career by just holding on and later harvesting capital gains. I keep confusing those two things. The tax is an issue, but it's nowhere near the issue that's made out to be.
Okay, interesting. You know, you have these dividend kings and things, and companies that have been raising their dividend every quarter, every year, forever. And at what point does that potentially become a burden? Partly because you've set yourself up to disappointment. Is that a point of concern at all? And you mentioned that there was some concern with companies paying too much of a dividend or maybe buying back too much stock. Are we there in today's market?
Yeah, so the market's filled with all of these varieties. The SEC has naming rules, and they're really interesting to compare naming rules with the reality. I just would encourage all investors to look under the hood as to what you're actually getting. A friend of mine passed on to me a high dividend ETF that had NVIDIA in it.
What?
I don't know. They have NVIDIA in it. They also have Apple and Microsoft, both of which yield 50 basis points. And the SEC naming rules are reasonable. They're not unreasonable at all. And the reasonableness is that whatever you say you do, you have to do it for 80% of the portfolio. So it actually allows 20% of the portfolio to do other things. And so that's, you know, it fills the other 20%. There's nothing, and they probably have done very well by definition on the total return as a consequence of that. There are also the dividend aristocrats. And again, I just encourage people to think about that. It's a really clever marketing strategy. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not illegal. Again, it fits well within the legal framework and has been super successful in the marketplace. But think about the math. 25 years of dividend increases. There's a hard way to do that and an easy way to do that. The easy way to do that is to start with companies with very low yields but are very successful businesses. And they are able to grow their dividend and they maintain low yields. The problem from a income perspective is the starting low yield. I could remove the risk. In my day job, I oversee portfolios that have higher yields, lower dividend growth rates, but higher yields, and take more dividend risk, dividend investor, dividend risk. I could get rid of all that, get the yield down to 1.5%, and have nothing but a narrative based on extreme dividend growth and no cuts ever. The problem is grandma would struggle to eat because the income stream is so low. So just take a look. Listen, in a total return environment, those dividend aristocrats have done very, very well the last 15 years. But just take a look. If your interest is the stock market, that's a really reasonable conservative approach to the stock market. If your interest is business ownership and a tangible income stream, it's challenged because the income level of the U.S. stock market's 1.5%. A bunch of those dividend aristocrats are right around 1.5%, 2%, some cases below 1.5%. They basically, you can, again, with the naming rule convention, without difficulty, without violating the rules, you can call a product a dividend product in the U.S. stock market and have the yield of the S&P 500. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. The S&P 500 has a dividend. It's just not a very high one. So it's a matter of, looking under the hood of the vehicle and saying, okay, this works for me. Or no, I didn't actually think about that. This works less well for me. From a material dividend perspective, the S&P has a higher dividend growth rate than a high dividend product because the yield's so low.
Right.
But, the net present value of the income stream, which is why I'm in business. I can't speak for why others are in business, but the net present value of the income stream is challenged when you have a upfront yield that's so low.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
Warren Buffett famously says that he doesn't believe in dividends because he thinks the company should management should pay everything back into the company. I'm assuming you don't quite buy that either, given your title of your book and other things.
Yeah, and the difference is that I represent, as an individual investor and even as an aggregation of individual investors, minority shareholders, meaning non-majority shareholders.
Warren Buffett. So is Warren Buffett, doesn't he?
No, well, when he started out, perhaps, but now he either buys the entire company or he has enough shares that he can pick up the CEO and show up at the, the board meeting and have an impact on capital allocation. He loves getting his checks from his companies. He just doesn't pay them out to his shareholders. That's an agency issue. And not to get too academic with your listeners, but a dividend is a way for a minority shareholder to keep management's feet to the fire. This is, some of this just comes down to basic, you know, playground psychology, or I have a teenager, I'll call it teenager psychology. If my teenager has a lot of money in his product pocket, it is poorly spent. If my teenager has less money in his pocket, it is less poorly spent. It's, to some extent, it's not more complicated than that. And an obligation to pay a dividend, if you're a successful business, if you're not a successful business, if you're a biotech, if you're a startup, you're probably not getting dividend investors anyhow.
Of course,
you shouldn't be paying dividends. But if it's a successful, profitable business, then as a minority shareholder, it's completely reasonable, validated by 5,000 years of history and every chapter of every finance book, that you would want some evidence of that to be passed back to the shareholder. And again, not buybacks. They don't go to shareholders. They go to share sellers. Mm-hmm. Important difference.
Great
to be Warren Buffett, but most people are not Warren Buffett. They don't have a 10% share of whatever company. He doesn't take board seats, I think, anymore. But he has his Rolodex, a very out of date term on the phone. His Rolodex is one that he doesn't have agency costs the way the rest of us do.
Yeah,
and so in. You know, again, I don't do my own brain surgery, and sadly, I no longer even mow my own lawn. The kid who mows the lawn doesn't do it exactly the way I would, but for me, it's worth it to have him do it rather than me. I pay him. There's an agency cost in everything. We may own shares in a fizzy drinks company in Atlanta, a company whose product I quite like, particularly the zero sugar variant, but they don't exactly do it the way I would do it. But I don't want to drive the trucks. I don't want to come up with the formula. I don't want to come up with the jingle. I don't want to work in the bottling plant. So I pay them to do it. It's an agency cost. The same thing goes in the other direction, that to be a shareholder in said company, I want to, executives have access to the capital that essentially we've provided, but there's a cost, I have to pay a dividend. It's a reasonable compromise within a complex world where we have scale and have outsourced many functions to other people because they do them better than we do. Warren Buffett has overcome that by virtue of his personal scale. Congratulations to Berkshire Hathaway. And again, in recent decades, they've bought entire companies.
Yeah.
So they do control the cash flow. And for companies where they have minority stakes, they get some pretty big dividend checks.
Mm. You speak of cash flows and the importance thereof. And it would seem that this era of the stock market has a little bit better focus on those types of fundamentals than ones did in the past, especially if you look at the dot-com era, which is what this era is often compared to. I mean, those companies were going public without revenues.
Yeah.
And now you have a company that, like NVIDIA, which has huge margins, you know, a huge order book, and is overbooked and can't produce their products fast enough.
Right.
So is it safe to say that that kind of thing has been vanquished, or are you still seeing a lot of concerns or a lot of people without any concerns about cash flows? And I am not asking you about digital currency yet.
About the what currency?
Cryptocurrency.
For those of us who kind of have a historical take on these things, you're absolutely correct that the internet bubble is not the proper compare. It's really the Nifty 50 or the late 1960s growth companies. In that time period, you had one of those Nifty 50, Fangs, Mag 7, whatever. But in the late 1960s, you had real companies doing very, very well in business. And then their stock prices went crazy. The stock prices subsequently crashed. The businesses did or did not over the subsequent 50 years, but the businesses were fine. It was the stock prices that got out of whack. And if you look at most of the FANGs, there's one I have some degree of antipathy towards, whether it's FANGs or FANGs or Mag 7. I have one kind of one company that I have an issue with, but the rest appear to be very legitimate, very, I don't call them stable, but very successful businesses. And they're going to have to pedal really hard to keep up that success, but they're obviously very, very successful. It's not, so that's not the issue. It's the, it's just the valuation and sucking the air out of the other 493, the stock market air out of the, from the other 493. So no casting no shade on those companies. The underappreciation of dividend investments and dividend focused companies, it's not because people are distracted by we'll call them bad businesses. It's the stock market inefficiency.
Mm. All right. Okay, Daniel Paris, I want to take a short break and then come back and ask you some more questions about your book, about yourself, and if we can, maybe about where to look for dividends or buybacks or what have you, income, I guess. But let's take first a short break. If you are a premium subscriber, you do not get the break. Do not touch the dial. We'll be right back. In fact, you already are. Everybody else, to become a premium subscriber, visit the website contrarianpod.substack.com and sign up.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
By the way, you don't need the .tech suffix to get to that website. .com will do the trick. And we also have a Substack that you can, where you can sign up for the same prices, same benefits, same details, contrarianpod.substack.com. So if you already have a Substack account and use it, or have the app and use that, that's probably the best way to go. So contrarian.supercast.com or contrarianpod.substack.com, whole bunch of benefits, including, of course, getting this episode up to a week early without ads or annoying announcements. And you also get the Daily Contrarian briefing and podcast that is released every market day morning at 7 a.m. This is a contrarian take on the events of the day ahead and what is likely to move markets, such as economic data releases, earnings, and other things. It is really good, and that is completely unbiased, of course. So check that out, contrarianpod.substack.com or contrarian.supercast.tech. Now on with the show.
Welcome back, everybody. Here with Daniel Paris, author of The Ownership Dividend. Daniel, this is the section of the show where we like to ask our guests a little bit more about themselves, how they started off investing, their origin story, to put it in Marvel terms, and how they arrived at their current station in life. So I know this is not your first book, is it?
But it is not. My fifth. But my origin story, I started out as a superhero in a comic strip, and then I came to life. So
we have not heard that before.
Yeah, and I decided rather than being a superhero, I'd rather be a fund manager. So that's, you know, I'm waiting for the movie, but so far the phone has not been ringing. I do have an origin story, a little bit unusual. I was trained as a historian of the former Soviet Union in the 1980s and 90s, late Reagan Cold War. I went in and then came out in 1994 with a fresh PhD in modern Russian history, and the Soviet Union had disappeared. And so to that world and funding and my, I taught briefly for a couple of years, but after several years, I decided to go into business instead. So I left academia, and I transitioned the writing and research skills of my prior career into doing initially stock research for an independent stock research firm. And then after 9/11, my wife and I moved out of New York to Pittsburgh, and I joined Federated as a senior analyst and quickly became a portfolio manager on the dividend suite of products there. And I've been doing that for the last 17, 18 years, 16 years, something like that. But soon after I settled in Pittsburgh with Federated, my historian inclinations came back out and I started writing again. So you can take the boy from history, but you can't take the history from the boy. And I started writing books about dividend investing and modern portfolio theory, all from a very strongly historical orientation in 2011, 13, 18, and now the ownership dividend in 2024.
Wow. How does one go from being a historian in Russian history to a dividend investor? It sounds like you're skipping a couple steps there.
I skipped a couple steps. And if you asked my wife, she would say somewhat unpleasant that transition. And frankly, it was difficult. If you are 34 years old in 1990, 33, 34 years old in the mid-1990s, and you are calling upon Wall Street consulting firms and having never opened up an Excel spreadsheet before in your life, you are at a distinct disadvantage and having had no background in business whatsoever. But I knocked on enough doors and I found someone who said, okay, I understand you know nothing about business, but you can write quickly and you can speak well. I can use that in my consulting business. And that lasted for a year. And I got basically an on-the-job MBA. Very difficult, very unpleasant for everyone involved. I'm glad I survived it. But I did, and I had a few short transition jobs like that. And I would call out a research manager at Argus Research in New York, John Eed, a wonderful guy, still the head of that operation. He gave me a chance to hone my skills there. And I was there for 3 years until 9/11. And that's where I really got settled in and made the transition from historian of modern Russian history to stock analyst and then portfolio manager.
Wow. Okay. Do you still monitor current events and such? And
All the time, and still write on Russia as well.
What's your views on the Russia-Ukraine thing and Russia's future?
Yeah, it's a mess. Now, I haven't added any value by saying it's a mess, but it is a tragic mess, and it's not that surprising if you're familiar with Russian history, given the issues that animate Russian leaders, their relationship to the West, their identity. But it was a catastrophe, catastrophic move, and a catastrophe all across. And I am, still wrestling with that. When the deadline for this book lapsed a year, and I was behind, and I called the editor up and said, listen, I'm not going to meet the deadline for the book. And she said, why? She said, well, Russia invaded Ukraine. And I said, but your book's about finance. And I explained to her my backstory and my interest and continuing interest in this. And she said, okay, I get it. You have an extra year. But I lost probably 6-9 months just because of the fury associated with watching what was going on, the tragedy. Sadly, it's going to continue. And at the core of it, and something I'm thinking of, have written about and will continue to write about, is the kind of the Russia and the West. Russia for centuries has struggled as to, is it a Western nation? Is it its own thing? Is it not Russian, not a European nation, and what is the right relationship with the West? And we're seeing that play out in real time, that uncertainty about its relationship to the West. And so, and sadly, I don't see any easy or quick resolution.
Do you have any ideas on an end game? Is it just going to be Russia, China, and North Korea and this bloc opposing the West, or?
I very specific end game is I think that the stalemate in eastern Ukraine is going to remain, and it's quite possible or even likely that Russia is going to continue to occupy those elements. I don't know that China makes a lot of sense as casting its fate with Russia. China can kind of do better on its own. I look a lot at the demographics of Russia, and if you look at the geography and the demographics, you see some very interesting phenomenon. Crimea is really important to Russia as a forward military base. It's kind of undefensible, but it's a forward military base. Kaliningrad, the former Königsberg, is a forward military base. And even the Russian Far East, Vladivostok, is a forward military base. The problem is that Russia's population is collapsing catastrophically and very rapidly. And of course, the war is making it collapse even faster. And one of the reasons, maybe not the top one or two, but one of the reasons in the top five easily that Russia invaded Ukraine was to get population, because they're desperate for population. And Russia is kind of shrinking. It's a huge landmass, but it's shrinking from a population perspective. Now, the whole northern world is also shrinking, but they're shrinking faster. And they're going to have a hard time maintaining Crimea. Crimea came into Russia's control in 1783. It left, call it 1991, came back 2014. They're going to have a hard time. Königsberg, Kaliningrad, you know, kind of essentially picked up after World War II. It's now surrounded by other countries that are not friendly to Russia, Poland and Lithuania. It is non-contiguous with Russia. Vladivostok and much of the other Russian Far East territories taken from China in 1858 and 1860 by treaty. China was weak, Russia was strong. Now that's reversed. And if you look at a satellite map of those territories, on one side, it's densely populated with a lot of infrastructure. And on the other side, it's largely barren. So the borders of countries do move. We saw huge border movements after World War II. Most people living in their own time assume that borders are fixed. But if you have even a slightest historical sensibility, you know that the borders move. And that's what we're seeing. Putin does have that sensibility and intended to move the borders. It just backfired and did not work. And he has his reason to do so, because they're collapsing demographically and kind of geopolitically. He's trying to stave that off, not very successfully.
Mm. Wow. Okay. All right. On to more pleasant matters, and back onto topic here. Dividend investing, and yours is limited to the stock market versus REITs versus fixed income or any other area. So we'll talk about that. And just broadly, in broad terms, is there anything, without mentioning individual stock, in terms of sectors, is there anything interesting that you're observing right now as far as sectors that are more compelling from a dividend paying standpoint than they were in the past, perhaps?
Yeah, so the book makes the argument that the non-dividend paying sectors are going to come online. Mm. And I got very lucky. I would say I was very skilled, but actually I just got very lucky. The book was published on January 31st. The very next day, Zuck announced the dividend. So obviously he got an advanced copy, read it, agreed with it, and got the board on board in 24 hours, and boom, a dividend announced.
Now, hang on, is that insider trading? No, I'm kidding. Go on.
So, Salesforce did the same thing a week later. There are going to be more tech companies announcing dividends. Now, if you look at the size of those dividends versus buybacks and the yield of those income streams, they're de minimis. They're not really relevant for the dividend investor, but they're important symbols. You are going to see, with interest rates, the theme running through the book is what happens when interest rates go down for 40 years. And then in the second half of the book, or relevant to the second half of this conversation, is what happens when interest rates stop going down and you have the return of the cash nexus. You're going to see more companies having to compete for capital, much like fixed income, much like real estate, much like money funds, government bonds, private enterprises, even private equity. It's going to have to start competing on actual cash flows. The U.S. stock market, you haven't seen that yet. But prescience or luck or just whatever to Zuckerberg to realize that the tech companies are going to have to start competing for capital. They are asset light, very cash flow generative. Semiconductor companies have historically paid dividends. They're much more capital intensive. It is an irony of income investing that the capital intensive ones are the ones that pay dividends. That's not ironic, because if you look at the history of those companies in the 19th century, the railroads, which were very capital intensive, were the biggest dividend payers. They had to be. Where do you know where preferred shares came from? After railroads initially went bust with their initial capital, the only way they could raise additional capital was to have preferred shares with preferred dividends so that those investors would get paid first. So you're going to have the return of normal asset allocation. What that means for investors, for your listeners, is pretty straightforward. The opportunity set is going to get larger. That's good. It also means one bad thing, and the bad thing is the opportunity set's going to get larger. You're going to have more choices to make. But look for more companies in the tech space and consumer discretionary, particularly those that have come up in the last 30 years in a dividend-free environment, they're gonna have to change. So that's both, it's good and not, I'm not going to say bad, it's just more challenging because you're going to see more of them. And that's fine. The other, there are other kind of consequential elements of this, but you mentioned earlier companies that, you know, pay too large a dividend. That can be dealt with through diversification, but there are companies, the U.S. pattern of dividend payments is restrictive. It's every quarter, raise it every year. And there are companies in mature industries who get into trouble with that. There are patterns of payments outside the United States and in selected pockets in the U.S. that are much more flexible. A base dividend with a special dividend on top that can vary. You see that in the energy space. You see that in family-controlled companies. Fixed payout ratios, which are truly fixed. So if earnings go down 1 year, the dividend goes down, but at least the company's been true to its communication if it has a 50 or 75% payout ratio. Those are far more flexible than pay a quarterly dividend, raise it. And I do think that when dividends do make a comeback, that is when the return of the cash nexus occurs, it will occur with an increasing degree of healthy variety. Right now, for instance, special dividends are viewed dimly in the marketplace because companies aren't rewarded with their share price when they pay a special dividend. But from the perspective of an income investor, special dividends are great. So as that sensibility comes back, I think you'll see a greater variety of payment plans. It's early days yet. A number of midstream companies and oil companies were experimenting with that a couple of years ago. Didn't actually go that well. The stock market's not ready for it yet. But I think you will see more variety. And investors can deal with that in a very simple fashion. If you own 30 or 40 of the income streams or hire a professional to do that, then the variety of income stream payment patterns all disappears and you get a nice income stream. But from an individual company perspective, look for more companies paying more dividends and a greater variety of said payments.
Mm. You mentioned just consumer discretionary. Wouldn't that be a little risky just given how fickle consumer tastes are?
And that's why you need greater variety of payment patterns.
Yeah,
so you have companies that are phenomenally successful, but you know they're not going to be doing this 15 years from now. Yeah. You know, how do you get the income stream? Well, you either harvest a capital gain if you're lucky enough to time it well, or you know, one-time dividends if they are kind of windfall companies, fashion companies that come and go. That's an option. It's just not a common option in the U.S. stock market when interest rates are zero. When interest rates and risk rates, what I draw a distinction in the book and at length distinction in the book between risk rates and interest rates, when risk rates are not zero, you're going to see more investors demanding more cash from successful businesses, just like in real estate, just like in private property, just like in other stock markets, just like the math of the Contrarian podcast. If you get a huge advertising or subscription revenues, then Nat Baker gets to take home a bigger paycheck. It's not that controversial.
Mm. Yeah. Bigger, very relative in this case, but yes. what if anything, does this current kind of era of dividend payments say about the cycle, the stock market cycle, if anything? Are there any conclusions that can be drawn there?
Yeah, and that's the title of the book and the whole structure of the book is around a paradigm shift. And this is very interesting, I think, and important, and to some extent controversial. We've been in a 40-year paradigm. Everyone who subscribes to you, unless you have some very elderly subscribers, everyone who subscribes to you has come up in the current environment. Current environment meaning declining interest rates, declining risk rates, rising buybacks, global neoliberalism, outsource everything to China, just-in-time management, just-in-time efficiencies, Wall Street efficiency, buybacks help EPS, help companies look better, get the share price up. Doesn't matter about cash flows. Blessed by consensus of both academics and politicians, deregulation, easy globalization. That really started in the 1980s. Deng Xiaoping comes to power in China in 1979, Margaret Thatcher in 1979 in Great Britain, Ronald Reagan in 1980. Interest rates, the 10-year, the interest rate that matters to most equity investors at peaks in 1981. The SEC rule allowing share buybacks, comes into play in 1982. NASDAQ really, you know, starts taking off significantly in that time period. NASDAQ meaning Silicon Valley innovation, tremendous innovation, companies that you would not want to pay dividends because they were busy changing the world. So, you know, no problem with startups and innovative companies growing rapidly, not paying dividends. All these factors occur at the same time. The Soviet Union begins to collapse a little bit later, a few years later. Francis Fukuyama, the end of history that global neoliberalism or the neoliberal ideas prevailed, U.S. hegemony, and it becomes efficient and doable to outsource everything to China. And so that happens. It goes for 40 years. We import deflation from China via Walmart for decades. Wall Street's very happy. Stock market goes up significantly during this period. Seems to be working very well. And you have two generations of people who are in that environment where they don't remember or know a period in which risk rates aren't always going down. Leverage, more leverage is always good. And the next opportunity is around the corner. That all comes to a crashing end in the last couple of years. Glimpses of that crash in 2016 with Brexit and the initial appearance of Donald Trump. But in 2020, you have COVID in China calling into question the global supply chain that you, if your whole business is dependent upon a pallet arriving from Asia 2 days before you need it, and that's your sole source manufacturer, lowest cost sole source manufacturer, that worked for decades. And then boom, suddenly it doesn't work at all. You have Donald Trump's orchestrated coup attempt in 2021, which shows the degree to which the political consensus has disappeared. We no longer not only don't agree, we don't even feel the need to even try to agree anymore. And you can see that continuing to play out in the current political environment. Interest rates bottom in September, the 10-year in September of 2020. Russia invades Ukraine, yet another shock to the global neoliberal paradigm. So that paradigm came into being, and dramatically came to an end the last couple of years. And it's very difficult for investors, business people, politicians, to figure out what the future is going to look like. But I don't think it's going to look like the past. There are big implications for private equity. You've seen a lot of commentators calling into question all of those environmental factors were so positive for private equity as an asset class. We shall see going forward. But even I think the U.S. stock market's going to change dramatically in the ways that are outlined in the book. But investor sensibility needs to change as well, expecting a cash return for a cash investment and probably a more conservative approach. I am not a bear market person. I'm very much a cash person, and I expect to see the return of the cash nexus in investing relationships.
That is all very interesting. Wow. Okay. And do you see the reshoring going on? U.S. manufacturing coming back and opportunities there potentially.
Yeah, and you would be in a better position to know some of the names that are relevant there. But I think the way I would put it would be re-vertical integration. Mm-hmm. And I am in the public media talking about Boeing. Boeing's relationship with Spirit is a perfect example. They spun it out in order to optimize their balance sheet and their optics. And now they're going to have to buy back in or do something. They're going to have to spend a lot more money to reintegrate the vertical quality control of their business. And they're not alone. There'll be a lot of other corporations. If it's not full vertical integration, it's going to be greater vertical integration. And even in service businesses, you're going to have to see greater investment in vertical quality control. Mm-hmm. I put a number in the book, 200 basis points of margin from the S&P 500. How did I come up with that? I guessed it. The S&P non-financial margins have improved 400 basis points in the last 20 years. I just took half of it. And so you're going to have to reinvest that back into quality control. Whether that means actually buying businesses back in, reshoring, friendshoring, or just investing more in processes. I characterized it as the shift from Wall Street efficiency, which is the share price, to Main Street efficacy. Boeing was optimized for the former. It's going to have to move to the latter, along with a lot of other corporations that are going to have to move more towards efficacious business models rather than efficient business models. Guess what? That's going to cost more. So you can think about some of your holdings to your listeners or prospective holdings and ask, you know, are they well set up for a period of greater investment in quality control, vertical integration, or are they already there? There aren't too many that are already there. Are they really, you know, if it's a really asset-light business that purports to deliver a good or service that it relies entirely upon others to deliver, you may want to pause.
Yeah. All of which will likely result in higher prices for consumers and potentially, right?
Combination of, you know, I call for a margin reset. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. Others have reacted to my comment in the same way you do, that it's inflationary. I don't know if it's inflationary, but I do think that Wall Street's going to have to spend more. Whether they recoup it in pricing, it really depends on how good the product is. Again, if your product only sells because you can make it so cheaply because you've outsourced everything and are asset light, you may struggle in the marketplace and you may not have the option of raising prices. You just may not be able to, if you have to spend more to do the same thing, you can only get the same amount of revenue. Well, that's the margin reset.
Yes. All right. Daniel Paris, very interesting conversation here with you. In closing, maybe tell our listeners how they can find out more about you. I don't know if you're on the social media at all, but and how they can get the book. And I will put this in the show notes as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Nat, for having me on the show. The Ownership Dividend is available every place books are sold. It is published by Routledge. If you're interested in a discount code for the Routledge website, please get in touch. I am also accessible through the standard social media. I use the handle History Investor, which hopefully is accurate. I am History Investor on most, not all social media, but most social media and under my own name on LinkedIn.
That's cool. We just had a guy, a History Investor, but he doesn't own that because you do. But interesting. Very cool. Awesome. Well, thank you, Daniel, for coming on. Thank you all for listening. And we'll be back here again in a week or two with our next guest. Speak then. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.